WBUR. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America is in a patch of rough water with its historic European allies. With Europe split over support for a U.S.-led war on Iraq, we'll look tonight at key allies, the rifts between them, and what it all means for Washington and the transatlantic future. We begin with the news from this week's meeting of NATO defense ministers in Warsaw, Poland. Over the next 2 days, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld will meet with his counterparts from 19 NATO nations as the U.S. plans for war. Peter Ford is senior European correspondent at the Christian Science Monitor in Paris. I asked him what we should expect to hear from Rumsfeld in Europe.
Well, I think what he really needs to do is to try and explain the American position as clearly and as sympathetically as possible, because Europe's all over the board on this. Its reaction has reached from the United Kingdom, where, of course, Tony Blair is right behind George Bush, and indeed tomorrow, Tuesday, will be releasing a dossier, a 50-page dossier, which he says proves that Iraq has nuclear and biological chemical weapons. Through to Germany, where Gerhard Schröder has just won re-election, is absolutely opposed to any attack on Iraq, with or without United Nations approval. In between, you have the Italians, who are sympathetic to the Americans. You have the French, who would perhaps go along with a multilaterally agreed United Nations action, but are opposed to preemptive action. Europe just can't make up its mind on this.
Donald Rumsfeld's people say that the NATO meeting is not about Iraq, it's about NATO business. But can Iraq be avoided at this Warsaw meeting?
Donald Rumsfeld is bound to spend some time briefing everybody else at NATO on what America has planned, or at least the sort of options from which it is going to choose. But it's true that there's a lot of NATO business to be done. There's going to be a big summit in November in Prague when NATO will accept up to seven new members from the former communist bloc. Preparations for that have to be made. And there is an American proposal that Rumsfeld is going to be broaching for a rapid reaction force that he wants NATO to have up and running in the next couple of years, ready to deal with threats and attacks at a week or so's notice. So everybody is waiting to hear what he proposes for that. It seems clear that NATO itself will not be playing any role in any eventual war in Iraq that's coming up. This will be an American war with such friends as it can get on board.
But what about the tensions over action in Iraq? Do they threaten to further erode the coherence of NATO? There's been a lot of talk in recent years about how NATO's own definition and mission have become obscure in the post-Soviet era. Does the great flap that we're seeing over Iraq threaten to worsen that kind of erosion of clarity?
Well, I think it certainly reflects and divisions amongst NATO members as to what exactly military force is for, where it should be used, and who should be using it. NATO does have to redefine itself, and I don't think there's any doubt that when the Prague summit is held, they will come up with a new plan. There's no need to defend Western Europe against Soviet aggression anymore. It seems clear that they will be defining new roles, out-of-area roles, as they call them, beyond Western Europe, beyond the Atlantic region, and they are thinking in more flexible terms, as the Americans would like them to do. But there's a long way between doing that sort of thing and signing up for an invasion of Iraq.
You're based in France. We've seen Germany's response to the U.S. push on Iraq. How would you describe the French position on military action and Iraq?
Very strongly against unilateral action. In fact, there was a summit Monday in Copenhagen between the European Union countries and Asian countries, and President Jacques Chirac of France tried to get the meeting to pass a resolution condemning unilateral military action in Iraq. He failed. He came up against Silvio Berlusconi's opposition. France's position is that if anybody starts taking unilateral action, or certainly preemptive action, there's nothing to stop anybody else doing it. I mean, Chirac said the other day that if the United States went into Iraq unilaterally because they feel that there is a threat, even if the United Nations doesn't perceive it as such, then what's to stop the Indians or the Pakistanis or the Chinese going in preemptively and unilaterally in their conflict? And I think that's at the heart of French concerns.
And in the UK, across the channel, Tony Blair's been a very staunch ally, but we hear that there are some signs of a rift with the British Parliament, talk of an emergency meeting of Parliament supposedly taking place tomorrow. Does he have internal dissension over his strong support for action in Iraq?
Certainly. Even within his cabinet, there are dissenters who don't agree with any armed action in Iraq, certainly not with unilateral action by the Americans without a Security Council mandate. It doesn't matter. Tony Blair has such a massive majority in Parliament that even if some of his own Labour Party members defect and vote against him, he will still carry the majority. He does seem to be winning the public opinion battle. A couple of weeks ago, a clear majority of British people were opposed to military action in Iraq. That clear majority is eroding. But elsewhere in Europe, it's quite obvious that most people do not think it's a good idea. That was clearest in Germany. And I think what has surprised the Americans more than just the sort of language that some German politicians used against the idea of an invasion of Iraq and against America during the recent campaign, what surprised people was that that actually moved voters. The German voters responded very, very positively to anti-American sentiments.
What does that tell you, Peter Ford, about the future of U.S.-European relations?
They will have to be handled very sensitively. I think in the end, I think if the United States decides to invade Iraq, there won't be any European government that will actually stand in its way. For the French, for example, and the Security Council will probably find a way to accommodate the Americans. But it is quite clear that everybody in Europe has reservations, put it that way, about the sort of preemptive strike doctrine that the Bush administration has just revealed, because people in this Atlantic are just not sure where that might lead.
Peter Ford, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Peter Ford is senior European correspondent at the Christian Science Monitor. He joined me from Paris. In Germany, Chancellor Gerhard Schröder campaigned for and last weekend won re-election on anti-war, some say anti-American, defiance. In Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair was blindsided in Brighton yesterday, challenged by a Liberal Democrat leader to define regime change in Iraq and define it quick. In France, President Jacques Chirac is treading delicately, one eye on Schröder, the other on George Bush. And at a gathering of NATO ministers in Warsaw, U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is giving Germany the cold shoulder and everyone else the full court press. So what's it all mean? With Europe divided over the prospect of a U.S.-led war in Iraq, which allies does America need most? Can it afford to lose any of them? And what will be the diplomatic fallout if it does? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined this evening by Catherine McCardle Kelleher. She's visiting professor of strategic studies at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. She's a former special representative for the Secretary of Defense in Europe. Good evening and welcome, Catherine McCardle Kelleher.
Thank you, Tom. Very nice to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. You're looking out on the same horizon that we all are, and you hear the ewing and hawing in Europe. There's a lot of there's an awful lot of tension there, to the point that anti-Americanism seemed to go almost to the heart of the German elections over this weekend and to the heart of the victory of Gerhard Schröder. What do you make of the degree of tension, of pressure in these relationships right now? What does it mean for the United States and Europe, and what does it mean for Europe internally?
I think it's really a very serious time. We mustn't be confused. There have been serious times before. Mm-hmm. And one only needs to remember the time of Vietnam to remember the last time we had tensions of this kind. But it is really something that goes to the fundamental character of the transatlantic partnership.
In the Vietnam era, of course, you had the Soviet Union still there with its shadow across Europe, which was a huge factor in whatever its misgivings about Vietnam, keeping the continent unified and keeping it allied with the United States. Not now.
No. And I think one of the aspects of this crisis that is somewhat overshadowed by the obvious anti-American side is the fact that Europe itself is so disunited. A Europe that so easily introduced a common currency last January can't really get its foreign policy together, as you've recounted and as Peter Ford so well described.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Why is that? What is it about the politics or the external interests of Europe's nations that leave it divided internally, let alone across the Atlantic?
Some of it's habit. I think Tony Blair's first instinct is to really, for example, put flesh on that long-standing Anglo-American partnership that so characterized World War II and also the Cold War. I don't think that's Gerhard Schröder's first instinct. It's a different generation in Germany now, a different leadership group. Gerhard Schröder, for example, in contrast to, say, Adenauer or even Chancellor Kohl, really hasn't spent much time in this country, doesn't know this country in anywhere near the depth that they did.
But it's not just something that lives in Chancellor Schröder's mind. It seems clear that the German public has got very deep misgivings about Iraq and the international posture out of Washington if his appeal to kind of anti-American sentiment is what swung the election.
I think here we're talking about something that's been building really since the Bush administration took office. I think many people expected that when the Bush administration came in, that it would bring with it a seasoned foreign policy team, one that was well-known in Europe and that was thought to be very interested and committed to the European partnership. Quite the contrary is the judgment that many European elites have raised over the past year. One is the rejection by the Bush administration of a whole series of international treaties and agreements and even negotiations that they viewed as very central to the future ordering of the international community. The ABM treaty withdrawal, the failure to accept the basic ground rules of the International Criminal Court, the question of really postponing or preventing any further discussion of a ban on biological weapons. All of these are things that have counted very heavily among elites. And with it, with that elite sentiment, comes a certain level of popular discontent and belief that the United States somehow is no longer interested in hearing what Europe thinks or what Europe wants. It wants people who are with us or against us, to quote the president's comment on the war on terrorism. Mm.
Catherine McArdle Kelleher, what do you think has brought us to this moment at this point in time? Why would it be that at the very sort of era when Europe is reaching toward more and more multilateralism, the United States is going unilateralist?
In part, it's because we can. There's no way that one can deny 10 years after the Berlin Wall fell that the United States really has a unique position of military primacy. When one looks around the world, even in among the great powers, one sees just an overwhelming predominance of American strength. We've seen the success of liberalism and the success of free market economies in so many different places. It would be hard to believe that our model is not the winning one, and that our judgments, and particularly our values, which have been embodied in this, weren't the winning answer for all states.
What does it mean if this is a lasting tension? If the United States stays, as the strategic policy released late last week would indicate, if it stays in a policy that's very ready to embrace unilateralism, and Europe continues to look on in something approaching horror?
I don't think that's really the case, though. I think that while one hears a great deal about unilateralism and certainly an emphasis on primacy in the new national strategy document that was leaked last week, one is really talking, I think, about a very different set of characters when one considers congressional leaders and even leaders of opinion in this country.
So you don't think that the United States is really on a long-term unilateral path, that this is an aberration we're in the midst of now?
I think that those, and there are some, who talk about the century of the American empire don't really understand what the American people want and the values that are involved in terms of cooperation and commitment. Who will go with us, which is always the question asked in the Congress whenever an event like this arises.
But whatever misunderstanding may be there, it appears we're about to go to war.
It does indeed. And the questions that are being asked, I think, by this administration are the right ones. And my hope is only that we will take the time and the effort, even in this most difficult of times, to find cooperative solutions with our allies. We'll need them. We can't do this without them. We certainly can't look at a post-attack Iraq that can be rebuilt without them.
We've got to take a short break. We'll come back and look at exactly what we can and cannot do without European allies. We're talking tonight about America and Europe on the eve of war, about friends and fault lines and fury. Do you want to hear Europe's objections or just a big yes, sir? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about continental rift this hour. On the continent and across the channel, who's in, who's out, and who does America most need in a war on Iraq? Our guest tonight is Catherine McArdle Kelleher. She's a visiting professor of strategic studies at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Her students have included National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. She's formerly director of the Aspen Institute in Berlin and a former special representative for the Secretary of Defense in Europe. You can join the conversation as well. What does it tell you that anti-Americanism was the decisive swing issue in Germany's election this past weekend? And is Europe just a nervous Nelly here, or is it telling the United States something important? We'll talk more with Catherine McArdle Kelleher in a moment, but first, German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder has made it clear that Germany won't click its heels just to make President Bush happy. Schroeder won re-election yesterday, largely, it's said, because of his tough-talking anti-war rhetoric. I spoke earlier with Jürgen Wilczewski, professor of international relations at the University of Kaiserslautern, and asked him just how important Schroeder's anti-war stance was to his victory.
The general public in Germany really has a problem with the idea of fighting a war against Iraq. So I think that it was pretty important for Chancellor Schroeder's victory.
And what's your interpretation of how much of this is sentiment against war with Iraq and how much reflects a broader anti-American sentiment?
I think it had to do a lot with domestic politics and the overall situation in terms of the upcoming election. However, one has to stress as well that there seems to be a big difference in terms of perception as well. The general public here in Germany, as well as the political elite, has a problem with the so-called aggressive unilateralism of the Bush administration with regard to Iraq. So I think it played both ways. It had a domestic touch as well as, you know, a general sentiment to it.
Now that the election has been won, do you imagine that Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder will find a way to patch things up with Washington, or have we done serious long-term damage to the German-American relationship here?
Well, there has been done damage to this relationship. And I think that we have very different points of view. However, if you listen to what Chancellor Schroeder had to say today, he already started softening his position, and he already started moving towards a more amicable interpretation of what's going on. He was talking about how vital and how solid the German-American relationship is. So he and his foreign minister will probably try to soften everything. And when you look at the justice minister, Frau Däubler-Gmelin, she just resigned. I think that is a clear indicator for a different approach.
This is the minister who drew apparently a broad comparison between George Bush's foreign policy and Adolf Hitler's.
Yeah, and which was absurd in many ways.
At a very practical level, if the United States goes ahead with military action against Iraq, even unilaterally, can you imagine that Germany might in fact restrict U.S. access to military bases in Germany?
No, I cannot imagine that. When you look at the relationship between Germany and the United States, you can see that there are problems, and I think that there are serious problems due to the overall understanding of what foreign policy should do. Here in Germany, lots of people, and Stoiber as well as Schroeder, indicated that they are very much interested in embedding foreign policy in a multilateral approach, whereas in the United States, as we know, the current administration is much more stressing a unilateral approach. And this really is a big difference in terms of the overall understanding of how things should play out. This is going to be with us for a long time, so we will have more problems to come, although I'd say that the rhetoric will calm down and will be very different now that the election in Germany is over.
As you say, the two countries seem to have a different view of how foreign policy should work right now. Chancellor Schroeder has said that friends, allies, should be able to have differences and talk about them. But are these is this a bridgeable difference? This seems to be a very stark difference in view of the world.
Well, it's a stark difference. However, the Bush administration went through the UN, and so Schroeder should be able really to make some changes as well and adjust to a softer position in terms of maybe a UN Security Council resolution.
Jürgen Wilczewski, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, and have a good day.
That was Jürgen Wilczewski, Professor of International Relations at the University of Kaiserslautern. We're talking tonight about America and Europe on the eve of war, about friends and fault lines, and no small bit of fury. What is it that America sees that many Europeans do not, that Europe sees that Americans do not? On the eve of potential war with Iraq, we're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm joined by Catherine McCardle Kelleher, a visiting professor of strategic studies at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. And Catherine McCardle Kelleher, you hear there the deep opposition in Germany at the level of the head of state to the U.S. position here. Germany has been right next to the United States ever since the end of World War II. What does it mean for Europe and for the United States to see this kind of gap opening between these two allies?
Well, I think we've seen it before, and we've also seen the ability of both Germany and the United States to move towards one another after differences have been articulated. Schroeder himself is the legacy of a real change in German foreign policy since 1990, when the Germans have progressively become much more involved in international peacekeeping and community building. In the Gulf War, remember, the Germans weren't even involved. They felt they had no right to send forces outside of their own country, that their constitution forbade it.
And now they're being pressured to take Turkey's place as the lead peacekeeping force in Afghanistan.
I think they will. And I think they're also involved, by my count at least, in 8 other peacekeeping operations all around the world.
So you don't see this as a watershed moment of tension. You think that this is all going to come be knitted back together in a war or post a war?
I'm not sure that it will be knitted back quite as smoothly as it was before, because I think it comes fundamentally to a question that maybe the United States hasn't answered for itself yet. What does it mean to consult with allies? Does that mean that allies get to say no? Does it mean that allies get to say, that won't work, we're with you on this phase but not in that phase? That's very different than the kind of concept of the NATO alliance, at least, that we've had since the 1949.
Catherine McCardle Kelleher, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Malcolm Chalmers. He's joining us from Bradford, England. He's professor of international relations at the University of Bradford and a senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Studies in London, author of A Transatlantic New Deal. Good evening and welcome, Malcolm Chalmers.
Good evening to you.
Thank you for joining us. We have seen from the very first days after last September 11th, the support of Tony Blair, kind of a rock of support, it has appeared, from the UK. But we hear all kinds of angry noise from behind and beneath him. How solidly is the United Kingdom behind the United States if and when it goes to war, even if that ends up being a war without UN sanction on Iraq?
Well, I think your last comment is absolutely critical. If there is clear UN sanction for military action, I think Blair will be able to carry public opinion and his party with him. But if military action were to take place without UN authorization, then I think Tony Blair would have very serious problems indeed, because the whole way in which the preparation for military action has been justified is as a means of enforcing UN resolutions.
What is going on with Parliament? We understand they're coming back into a special session. They're recalled from recess tomorrow. This is fairly unusual, is it not? And how does Iraq figure in the recall?
Well, that's the reason for the recall. There was a special meeting of the Cabinet this afternoon, and tomorrow there's a special session of Parliament to discuss the Iraqi issue. And the UK government, first thing in the morning, will be publishing a dossier which will provide information about how the government sees the threat of Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, which MPs will be able to read before the debate.
This then is presumably meant to influence the debate, or the session is meant to hash over what Tony Blair's showing or saying in a dossier that it is supposed, we hear this evening, to assert or give evidence that Saddam is very close to nuclear weapons.
I suspect on the particular issue of nuclear weapons, who knows what it will say? I certainly don't. But all the reports suggest that it won't say anything dramatically new, simply that if Iraq was to get access to fissile material, from another source, then he could become very close to it. But there's no evidence, as far as I understand, that he actually has such fissile material. But the purpose of the debate is to respond to widespread concern in the country that there hasn't been a chance for members of parliament to debate this question, and we are moving closer and closer to war. And Tony Blair will use this as an opportunity to put forward his view very clearly, that this is a problem that has to be dealt with. And in that sense, I think he's very close to the US. One of the things I think that made a big difference to the debate in the UK was President Bush's speech to the UN. I think in the weeks leading up to that, from people like Dick Cheney, the impression was given that the inspections process wasn't one we had to go through, that we could avoid the UN. And I think by coming to the UN, Bush achieved a lot in terms of winning people over. But there's clearly still an issue about whether that commitment to the UN process will be maintained.
George Bush has been very clear that if the Security Council fails to adopt a new resolution on Iraq, the United States will go it alone. We'll do what's necessary, including war if necessary. If that happens, what would it mean, what might it mean for Tony Blair's political prospects? Is it possible that he would be toppled?
I don't think it will go as far as that, but I think there is a lot of unease in the UK. There's probably more intense debate about this potential military operation than there has any military operation since Suez in 1956. We've got quite a number of former military people. We've got a lot of leading conservatives as well as Labour politicians, our Archbishop of Canterbury, many others who are raising some really very serious questions about this. I think the decisive issue is probably the issue of UN authorization. I know there's a discussion about a strengthened UN Security Council resolution, and I suspect that the US and the UK will get a strengthened UN Security Council resolution to strengthen the inspection process to make sure it works properly. So I don't think that's necessarily a problem. The problem would be if the US lost patience with the inspection process, a process which will inevitably last months and may interfere with the timetable for military action.
I have to say the patience already seems very thin here. It was essentially dismissed on the very morning after Iraq delivered its letter saying it would accept new inspectors. George Bush effectively said, this is eyewash. We've seen this all before. It's just a ruse.
Right. Well, certainly that's not the way the British government looks at it. After the cabinet meeting earlier today, the Foreign Secretary Jack Straw came out of that cabinet meeting and made it very clear that the threat of military action was there, but he still hoped that it would be possible to get through this crisis peacefully if Iraq was to accept inspections unconditionally throughout that country. So there's still certainly in public rhetoric an expectation by the British government that it's possible. It's possible that Iraq will accede to inspections and this crisis can be resolved peacefully.
It seems a lot less obvious on this side of the Atlantic, I would say. Listeners, we're at 1-800-423-8255. Do you want to hear Europe's objections or just a big yes, sir? Sarah's on the line. Welcome, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you. Europe is a very much older civilization than we are here in America.
Granted.
And I feel, my view is that they are representing what I consider the new zeitgeist, which is that the world is now weary of war. Wars just boomerang. They just hit you back with another one. And Europe has lived through it. All those people were in both wars.
Well, part of the world is clearly weary of it, and a lot of Europe may be, but what about Islamic fundamentalists, and what about George Bush's cabinet? Tired of war?
What about Hussein having all those awful weapons, and how can he dare send our young men over there to face them? Isn't Hussein going to throw them at whoever comes at him?
But is it better to leave him with the weapons?
Well, it's better to have the inspections and get rid of them. The first inspection people got rid of what they said, at least Bruce Ritter said, that it was 90-some percent of everything he had and that it was years before he would have a nuclear weapon. And he wouldn't dare use a nuclear weapon against us. I mean, we've got thousands of them.
Well, of course, we know the arguments that they could, even if he didn't, it could be passed on to a terrorist group. But, Sarah, let me put your fundamental point to Catherine McArdle-Kelleher, and thank you for your call, Sarah. Catherine, do you see this as a cultural difference, as a difference forged in different histories, that Europeans are just more weary and tired of war? In Washington, we almost hear the opposite kind of tone, that America is, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and ready for a new century and not going to take this kind of threat from Saddam or anybody else, even is ready to redraw the map of the Middle East. That doesn't sound like weariness.
I think it's really a question of a commitment to an answer. Washington is asking what is a very fundamental question. If one sees this continuing march of proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, what is it that the international community is going to do about it? Iraq is one case. There will be other cases. One looks forward and sees perhaps three or four other states beyond India and Pakistan that will in fact develop significant weapons of mass destruction in the next two decades. What is it that the international community can do to stop that development before it happens?
So you're at the War College, the Naval War College. Do you think Europe simply got it wrong, that that their adherence to the idea of inspections and solution short of war that we hear very widely voiced in Europe is wrongheaded somehow?
I don't think it's wrong. I just think it reflects a very different approach. Europeans are saying, let's try intermediate steps. Let's try diplomacy. Let's try the tools that we have and then decide if the risk is really grave enough to use the ultimate weapon, war. Certainly this administration views that intermediate stage as probably one that's going to fail, given the past record and Mr. Hussein's commitment. But I think they have come to understand, while not perhaps quite as thoroughly as Europeans would like them to do, that they are going to have to go through a phase of inspections, of carrying through the diplomatic method, at least until inspections are shown not to succeed.
And Malcolm Chalmers, can the United States and Europe remain good allies if they have this difference in perspective, this kind of multilateral, let's go for inspections versus the urge, you can feel it in Washington, I'm sure, to just go solve this thing once and for all?
I think it's going to be difficult. I think one of the things Europeans recognize is that there are debates going on in the United States, and the particular line we hear from Donald Rumsfeld, who's certainly not very popular in Europe right now, isn't the line that's taken by Colin Powell, and it certainly isn't the line taken by many other people in the United States, and administrations come and go, just as European governments come and go. So, but certainly there's a lot of worry about this particular administration. I think one of Tony Blair's challenges, I mean, Tony Blair still remains pretty popular in the UK, is to make it absolutely clear that whatever he does, he's not going to do it simply in order to please the Americans, that he's doing it because there are independent reasons for doing it.
Malcolm Chalmers, please stand by. Can the U.S. go it alone? Should the U.S. go it alone? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America and Europe on the eve of war, about friends and fault lines and no small amount of fury. Are you confident that if the United States acts, Europe will eventually just get in line? And what should Donald Rumsfeld be telling NATO allies in Warsaw? What should he be asking of them? Can the U.S. be prepared to go unilateral and be a good multilateral ally? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Catherine McArdle Kelleher. She's a visiting professor of strategic studies at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. And from Bradford, England, Malcolm Chalmers, professor of international relations at University of Bradford and a senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Studies in London. We're also joined right now by David on the line from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Evening.
Having
become so cynical with politics and basically just not participating anymore, I've become ambivalent about the whole war fiasco with Iraq. But let's look at the cold, hard reality of the situation, regardless of how ugly it is. The spoils of war with Iraq are immense. And I find it hard to believe that Europe, here in the short run, would not want to partake of that. I mean, we're talking what? How many several trillions of dollars worth of oil reserves, the potential contracts that could be worked with Iraq under a new regime.
So, David, you're imagining a U.S.-led victory and then the oil spigots somehow in the hands of the victors and all the money that comes with that and the contracts around that and saying, wouldn't Europe want a piece of that pie?
Yeah, they're in the same economic situation we are. We're all in bad shape right now. And I think the bypass on that, I think eventually the Soviet Union will come around just based upon the debt that they have with Iraq. And
their vote will be critical in the Security Council. But, David, let me put your question to Malcolm Chalmers. Malcolm Chalmers, how do the post-war, if there is a war, economics look from a European perspective? Does this look like a pie of lucre to be cut up, as David suggests?
I think there are certainly some people in Europe who see the U.S. motivated by oil in this particular crisis. And there are certainly some European oil companies which are very interested in taking part in that pie after a conflict is over. Certainly this is an issue perhaps most of all for Russia, which is in the worst economic straits of all of us, and its vote in the Security Council, I'm sure, will be tied to economic issues. But I think there are also Europeans who are concerned about what the American game plan is for Iraq after a war, because after all, there won't be any economic output of any sort unless there's a stable government in Iraq after war takes place. And that raises questions, I think, about the United States' staying power. We see in Afghanistan, we've seen elsewhere, that there certainly has been quite a lot of debate and uncertainty in the U.S. about whether they're actually willing to stay the course after an invasion, mm-hmm. or whether they want to get out and leave it to the Europeans to look after countries. And that's, I think, a concern.
Catherine McArdle-Keller, first to our caller David's question about the economics of this. Can you imagine the United States saying or suggesting in a way that would be diplomatically very clear, we're going into the Middle East. When this is over, we expect to have a very strong position vis-a-vis oil resources there, and you'd better line up with us if you want your oil supplies confirmed in the future.
I think that's one of the things that one doesn't need to say. It's pretty obvious in terms of the amount of oil that Iraq could, in fact, bring back to the world petroleum economy. And indeed, in the years before all of this, European companies, and particularly Elf of France, were indeed concluding all sorts of very lucrative contracts with Iraq and with Saddam Hussein in order to get their hands on what could be done in terms of the various schemes that exist for access to Iraqi oil. Mm. But I don't think this is the way diplomacy is done. I think it's closer to the fact to say that the United States might say to Russia that's just concluded a set of agreements with Iraq on nuclear power, mm-hmm. for about $60 billion worth over the next 10 years. We will be sure that whoever comes to power in Iraq, that your interests and your legal interests are in fact safeguarded. That's the kind of safeguard that one gets more diplomatically.
That the allies want to hear of. And you said earlier, Catherine McArdle, in regard to Malcolm Chalmers' comments on rebuilding Iraq, that if I heard you correctly, that you didn't think it would be possible without European allies post a presumed victory.
I think that's true. Unless one posits a very different kind of war than the one that seems to be being leaked out into our newspapers, one's talking about the need for a prolonged period of nation building. It's already the case that Europeans represent 5/6 of the troops that are in Afghanistan. One sees a similar percentage in ex-Yugoslavia, where European troops are and police are bearing the brunt of the reconstruction phase there. One can go on, East Timor, Somalia, all around the world. One's talking about the need for cooperation between the United States and particularly the major European countries in taking on the process of restoring these countries to political and economic stability.
And what is it exactly that the U.S. would need from Europe? Is it soldiers? We've got a lot of them. Is it the will to rebuild? Is it the know-how about how to rebuild? Catherine McArdle-Keller?
I think it's all of those. For example, one's discovered in the course of the various cases I just mentioned how very important the policing role is It's not something that we do at the federal level on the whole. It is something that, for example, the French, the Germans, and the British do very well and have a professional police force that's able to come in and help with the rebuilding of community that's so central in a post-conflict situation.
John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hello.
Good evening.
Good evening. I was just thinking about the pacifist view of most of Europe. And I think it's just kind of interesting that through the last century, there were two world wars.
Mm-hmm.
In both world wars, America had to basically come to the rescue and save Europe. And especially in World War II, had Hitler been confronted early on when it was obvious that he was building his military capabilities to take over Europe, and France especially and the rest of Europe were pacifists, not wanting to confront Hitler. Look what happened, and look what we had to do with American blood to solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're looking at a potentially similar situation, and again, Europeans are I think, cowardly avoiding the situation. And I think they'd probably prefer that America get whacked again and then act in defense measure versus, doing what we have to do to stop it before it happens. I think that's cowardly, and especially in with respect to what we did as Americans to save Western Europe in two world wars in a row.
We hear you.
Unbelievable that they're so blind to see what could happen. And I think they'd personally rather America, Washington, New York get whacked again versus us start a war to finish a problem before it happens.
I wonder, but let's put it to our guest from across the Atlantic, Malcolm Chalmers. And John, thank you for your call. Malcolm Chalmers, you hear in John's comments a sentiment that you no doubt know is very widely held in the U.S. The United States saved Europe twice. So where's Europe when we're – I guess there's two things. Does Europe still feel a debt of gratitude or an obligation because of World War's past? And secondly, what about the parallel between Hitler and Saddam Hussein that's often been drawn by this administration and by George Bush's father? Does that play in Europe?
I think certainly gratitude to the United States for World War II and for the assistance there for liberating Europe from the Nazis absolutely plays very strongly indeed. But the experience of World War II and having war on our territory and the enormous damage World War II caused also plays very heavily amongst Europeans, perhaps other Europeans more in the UK since we weren't actually invaded. We avoid invasion. So that experience of warfare means that we perhaps are aware that it's a very serious decision indeed to go to war with others. And I think the parallel between Hitler and Saddam Hussein can actually be overdone. After all, the period of the 1930s was one in which Hitler was engaged in territorial expansion, invading one country after another. Now, there would be a universal international consensus to confront Saddam Hussein if he was invading new countries, as he did in 1990 with Kuwait.
Mm-hmm.
He's not doing that. The issue is more controversial. So I think, and finally, I think the idea that the UK is pacifist is really rather misleading. The UK has been involved in military action in Kosovo, in Sierra Leone, mm-hmm. in Afghanistan mm-hmm. in the last 3 or 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Courtney's on the line. Hi, Courtney. You're on the air. Hello, Courtney. It sounds as though we may have missed her. Let's move on to another call. Jethro is on the line. Welcome, Jethro. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I first just wanted to respond to the idea of Europe being cowardly. I feel like the U.S. is entering, especially World War II, it was very late in the game. Hmm. I'd also say that in the past years, we've been acting very unilateralist relative to issues of global warming and recently the pulling out of the Conference on Racism in Durban, South Africa,
mm-hmm.
and feel that, Europe continues to provide a hand to us despite us pulling back on so many occasions. And I feel like it's very, not cowardly, but the opposite for someone like Chancellor Schroeder to be critical when so many people, even within our own country, are unwilling to be courageous at this time.
So you see courage on the other side of the line, Jethro. And thank you for your call. Malcolm Chalmers, try and take us to the heart of this. Are there different interests now between the United States and Europe that are leading them on these divergent paths? The United States with a more unilateralist tendency, Europe with clearly a more multilateral tendency. What is driving that?
I think one of the things driving it, is that Europe's experience is that we went through centuries of fighting with each other, and at the end of the World War II, with the assistance of the United States, it would not have been possible without America. We grew methods of cooperation between each other, which involved developing rules for international behavior, which limited our sovereignty, which made sure we never went to war with each other again. And that affects the way in which we see the world. We don't want a world in which countries decide for themselves whether to invade each other, but in which there are very clear rules and principles and processes which people have to go through. And that's why the UN is so important for Europeans. And it's about setting rules for the road. It's not about simply constructing ad hoc coalitions, which is a way I think people in the American administration seem to do it. It's seeing, well, what's the justification for doing this that doesn't justify other things which aren't acceptable? Mm. I don't think Europeans, certainly the British and the French, which are the two major military powers in Western Europe, aren't against military action against Iraq. But they want to be very clear about the circumstances in which that's legitimate.
Well, Catherine McArdle Kelleher, there clearly is a very different interpretation here of how rules ought to be applied. Washington wants UN resolutions applied to the letter and is willing to go to war right now, it appears, to do that. You also hear from Donald Rumsfeld and President Bush and Vice President Cheney that there are actors in the world who operate outside the rules and can't be dealt with in the niceties of diplomacy. That looks like a very different worldview.
I think it is, and I think it's one that very much reflects the kind of history that Malcolm Chalmers spoke about. I think the United States has been very fortunate in largely being spared from any kind of damage on its own territory, and as such has a different understanding of war. But I would argue that even in the United States, there's a wide range of opinion on this. Some of the research that I've done suggests that about a third of the country is willing to, in fact, use force in an international environment in which they have been told there is a wrong that needs to be righted. Another third is very reluctant to do so, and it's the president's job to convince, if you will, the middle one-third that what he's doing is correct. And if you look at the public opinion polls that have been taken, even though the president's personal support rating is very high, when one asks questions that suggest American action by itself without allies, without a UN resolution, one gets a rather different picture of how many Americans actually support this kind of action.
And very different picture when similar polls are done on the other side of the Atlantic. Malcolm Chalmers, we just have a few seconds left, but how much is at stake at this moment? Do we risk losing something essential in the transatlantic alliance?
I think we do. If this war occurs without clear UN authorization, and if the war goes badly wrong, which it clearly could do, there are all sorts of things that could go wrong, then it could deal a very serious blow to transatlantic relations. I think in the end, we will recover because we have so much in common, but it would be very uncomfortable indeed.
Malcolm Chalmers, thank you for joining us tonight. Malcolm Chalmers is Professor of International Relations at the University of Bradford. And Catherine McArdle Kelleher, thank you so much for being with us. Catherine McArdle Kelleher is Visiting Professor of Strategic Studies at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is W.